If you're joining us for the first time now for the summer session, welcome. And we're picking up on some themes that we discussed in the spring session, but I think that things will be understandable even for those of you who weren't here in the spring. So we're going very slowly through the laws in Parshat Mishpatim and what is called the Covenant Code. And I will share my screen here and get right to work on these texts. Okay. After dealing with the laws of slaves in the beginning of Exodus chapter 21, the Torah moves on to text the talk about homicide. Makeh ish vamit mot yumat. He who fatally strikes a man shall be put to death. If he did not do it by design, but it came about by an act of God, I will assign you a place to which he can flee. But when a man schemes against another and kills him treacherously, you shall take him from my very altar to be put to death. We started talking about these texts last time, but what we will say about them today will be, will stand independently for those who were not here last week. So the first thing I wanted to do, I think that this is well-known material, but it's just worthwhile to review it, to compare what's going on in the Torah with what's going on in rabbinic literature. Now, rabbinic literature counts up many of avot, many transgressions that are for which one gets the capital penalty, but it puts in place rules of procedure that seem to make it impossible for anybody ever to be put to death. I'm sure that people know the famous text from the Mishnah Makot, a Sanhedrin that puts someone to death once in 7 years is considered a destructive Sanhedrin. How could they do something like that? Even put one person to death in 7 years, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, no, once in 70 years, even that is considered destructive. It's, I think that's the simplest understanding of the text. The Gemara suggests that it's possible that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is saying that once in 70 years would be the ideal, that somebody should be put to death once in 70 years. But I think the simpler understanding is he's saying even once in 70 years, they would be considered destructive if they did something like that. And then Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva say, if we had been members of the Sanhedrin, no person would have ever been executed. And there's a fascinating discussion in the Talmud of how they would have arranged things in such a way that no one would be put to death when it's on the books, obviously, and you know, we've just read the verses in the Torah. Makeh ish vamit mot yumat. So what would they have done? How they would have interrogated witnesses in such a way to make it impossible for the witnesses actually to convict the accused? And then Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, in adopting that approach, they too would increase the number of murderers among the Jewish people. In other words, we have here one of the earliest recorded debates about capital punishment, with Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel representing the opinion of people who say that capital punishment is a deterrent. And if you think that you're saving lives by not putting murderers to death, actually you're causing more people to get killed, because if that deterrent isn't there, then people will go and will commit homicide. And so the kula that you have, this leniency that you have, being nice to the person who's accused of murder, may end up causing more people to be killed. I would argue that Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel's position seems to be a minority position in rabbinic literature. And Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva are the greatest rabbis of their generation, and they're saying we would have really arranged things in such a way that no person would have ever been executed. It's interesting to see how different scholars in different periods related to this text. In 1927, one of the first scholarly books written about rabbinic Judaism was written by a non-Jewish professor of classics and rabbinics at Harvard, George Foote Moore. He was definitely an Ohev Yisrael. He was definitely a philo Semite, and he was perhaps one of the first Christian scholars who presented the rabbinic worldview in a non-negative kind of way. I'm sure that all of you know that the New Testament is constantly contrasting Jesus' message with the message of the Pharisees. The Pharisees are the rabbis, and clearly the standard approach in Christian circles is to see that that Jesus' approach was a rebellion against rabbinic literature and an improvement on rabbinic literature. And George Foote Moore wrote comprehensive and unbiased, and one might even say positive, description of how rabbinic Judaism worked in 1927. And he writes here, "It is clear that with such a procedure," he describes the rules of procedure that went on in rabbinic literature about capital cases. He writes, "It is clear with such a procedure, conviction in capital cases was next to impossible, and that this was the intention of the framers of the rules is equally plain." There's no doubt that that's what they are trying to do. But these discussions were purely theoretical. Since I don't have this book with me, and I don't have easy access to a library, I'll just tell you that the continuation of the quotation from George Foote Moore is that, "Of course, one could come up with rules like this only once the rabbis were not in charge of keeping up law and order in their country." You know, you look at these rabbis here that are being mentioned here. All of the names of the rabbis who are being mentioned in this text live after Churban HaBayit, after the destruction of the Second Temple, and when already Jewish courts were not dealing with capital cases. The Jews had no right under the control of the Romans to have the Romans were killing many people. They had quite a system for capital punishment, but the Jews did not have a competing system going on at the same time. And George Foote Moore, representing the values of American society in 1927, when I don't think that there were any really strong voices speaking out against capital punishment in 1927, or perhaps, you know, a small minority of people might be against capital punishment in 1927. So George Foote Moore says, you know, okay, this is nice dreamers can come up with a procedure like this. If they were in charge of actually making sure that there is order in society, of course, they would be in favor of capital punishment. On the other hand, Professor Gerald Blitzstein, an American Jew who made Aliyah and who became a famous professor at Ben Gurion University of the Negev, he just passed away in the last 2 or 3 years. When he was still living in the United States, if I'm not mistaken, when he was still a graduate student, he wrote this paper called Capital Punishment, the Classic Jewish Discussion. And it's easily available on the web through academia.edu if anybody wants to read his analysis of this Mishnaic text and what it says about what the rabbis actually felt about capital punishment. And Blitzstein makes the rather bold statement that it isn't just the rabbis who created this idea of opposition to capital punishment, but that a careful reading of the Torah text, even though, you know, the passage that we just read right now, Plissken knows, knew these passages very well. He knows that it said, he knew that it said, Makei ish mamet mot yumat, but he said that the Torah hinted, in, if you read the text carefully, you'll see that the Torah is hinting that this is, you know, it's there for the rhetorical value. It's there to scare people. I'm going to ask, okay, Yehudiyef, raise the hand. Okay, unmute yourself if you'd like to ask a fast question. Go ahead.
Fast question. What makes you so certain that the Mishnah should be read as being against capital punishment? The three people who are expressing the opinion against are all people who are basically from the Beit Midrash. The person who's a Nasi, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who would really have to have the responsibility of doing it, is the person who's against getting rid of capital punishment.
Very good. Okay. I concede that that is a that's a legitimate reading of the text. I'm not trying to come down and say what the correct reading of that Mishnaic text is. I'm just saying that different people read it in different ways. And Gerald Blitzstein, when he was a student in the United States in the 1960s, when I think in the liberal circles on campuses in the United States, capital punishment was becoming less popular. So he created an exegesis, a way of reading the text that actually arguing that essentially Judaism has not been in favor of capital punishment. And you can read his article and see how convincing it is. And you can also read
I'm very familiar with him. I was his roommate.
Blitzstein's roommate.
Again, I think we have to see that.
Very nice. Oh, very
not only roommate, bunk mate, and camp.
Okay. Let's try to keep the rest of the comments to the end, so that we can, with a group this large of over 50 people, it's hard to have a discussion going on throughout the session. But we can continue the discussion afterwards. And if you were Blitzstein's roommate, my condolences to you on the passing of somebody who was just a wonderful human being and a great scholar of Judaism. So we can see that in the later tradition, people are unhappy about this. Some people are unhappy, and some people are trying to limit perhaps, as your point is, not the people who are in charge, or as George Foote Moore said, nobody is actually, Jews don't have to deal with the problem of being responsible for the public order in society, and that's when they're coming up with these kinds of texts. That's possible. And Blitzstein's point is that the Torah itself hints dissatisfaction with the idea of putting people to death. However, when you read the biblical text in its context in the ancient Near East, we see the opposite. We see that in virtually every society around the Israelites, there were different possibilities of how people would deal with homicide. And among the Israelites, there was only one way of dealing with homicide. And the Torah makes it very clear that there is one way of dealing with homicide, and that's that the murderer, mot yumat, shall surely be put to death. And, you know, you find this in every book of the Bible. Back in Genesis, you find Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafech, that he who spills the blood of another human being, his blood shall be spilled by another human being. You find it here in Shmot. You find it in Vayikra, makeh behema yishalmena umakeh adam yumat, that someone who kills an animal will make a monetary payment, and somebody who kills a human being shall be put to death. And there are verses also to the same effect in Bamidbar and in Devarim, in the passages in those two books that discuss the difference between an intentional, there's a lengthy description both in Bamidbar and in Devarim of the difference between somebody who commits murder intentionally and somebody who commits it accidentally, which was also, we saw that here in the already here in Shmot, we found this distinction between these two kinds of murderers, and then this is expanded on later in Bamidbar and in Devarim, and we'll have more to say about the expansion, probably not this week, but next week. Okay, so to get back to last week, we started to read this text by Professor Moshe Greenberg, written in 1960, before Professor Greenberg made Aliyah, when he was a professor at the at the University of Pennsylvania, and then he went on to become a really highly respected professor at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, made Aliyah around 1970 or 71, and passed away, I guess, about 10 years ago. So Professor Greenberg writes, the rite of pardon, we began reading this text last week, but we're going to continue now. The rite of pardon in capital cases that Near Eastern law gives to the king is unknown to biblical law. So in all law codes that come from the ancient Near East, the king is in charge of public order, and the king is able to pardon a murderer. This would seem to be another indication of the literalness which was the doctrine of the divine authorship of the law was felt in Israel. Only the author of the law has the power to waive it. In Mesopotamia, he is the king. In Israel, no man. It's not that the law does not come from a person, but the central idea of the Bible is that the law comes from God. And the central idea, when you read the law code of Vishnuna or the law code of Hammurabi or the various other law codes that are actually older than the Hebrew Bible, it is, you know, I, King Hammurabi, declare this to be the law. And so of course, if I am the one who is declaring the law, then I can relax the law. I can abrogate the law, as the rabbis say in rabbinic literature, Hey Mamru, the Hey Mamru. If they were the ones who actually came up with the law, then they are the ones who are also allowed to make an exception to the law. But the king does not have that power in ancient Israel. And a major theme of this article by Professor Greenberg is, what are the implications of saying that a law comes from God? And this is one of the implications. Greenberg goes on. This is the last text that we saw last week for those of you who were here, and then we'll go on to further parts of Greenberg's argument. The unexplained severity of biblical law on the subject of homicide has been considered primitive, archaic, or a reflex of Bedouin vendetta custom. But precisely the law of homicide cannot be accounted for on any such grounds. So Greenberg knows that there are biblical critics who say, oh, take a look. You look at Hammurabi and you look at Eshnunna, you look at various other law codes from the ancient Near East, they understood that sometimes you put the murderer to death and sometimes you don't, and sometimes there are other ways of dealing with it. And so there were some biblical critics who were critics in both sense of being a biblical critic, studying it critically and criticizing the Bible and saying the Bible is primitive, it's archaic, or it's, you know, it's, this is the kind of things that Bedouins do of killing each other, and that this is, it does not make sense when compared to the law codes of, to the other law codes of the ancient Near East. And now Greenberg will say what I consider it to be an incisive understanding of what it is that the Bible is saying about murder. Okay. In the earliest law collection, the covenant code of Exodus, it is laid down that murder is punishable by death. If homicide is committed by a beast, a goring ox is spoken of, the beast must be stoned and its flesh may be eaten. If it was known to be vicious and its owner was criminally negligent in failing to keep it in, the owner is subject to death as well as the ox, though here the law allows the owner to ransom himself with a sum fixed by the slain person's family. So, if your animal kills somebody, it says in the Torah, in verses that we'll see in a few weeks or months, it says, Gam be'alav yumat, the owner of the animal who was negligent in allowing his animal to go and kill another human being, he deserves to die, but he can ransom himself. But, Greenberg says, this is the sole degree of culpability in which the early law allows a ransom. The only ransom that Parshat Mishpatim knows about is in a case of negligent death. Negligent death in the fact that I didn't watch my animal fully. It is thus fully in accord with a later law of Numbers, which states you shall not take a ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. So that is the Torah's approach, that when there is a murder, then the murderer shall surely be put to death, and that murderer is not allowed to ransom himself or herself. A ransom may be accepted only for a homicide not committed personally and with intent to harm. For murder, there is only the death penalty. So what does this mean from an idea point of view? That's what Greenberg will continue to discuss. These provisions contrast sharply with the other Near Eastern laws on homicide. Outside of the Bible, there is no parallel to the absolute ban on composition. Composition means compensation, that in order to compensate for the fact that we took a life, money can be given to compensate for this between the murderer and the next of kin. All Near Eastern law recognizes the right of the slain person's family to agree to accept a settlement in lieu of the death of the slayer. Hittite law going so far as to regulate this settlement minutely in terms of the number of souls that must be surrendered as compensation. So you hand over if somebody from your family kills somebody from another family, then your family has to give a bunch of people. You know, they have fewer people in their family. And so if they could agree to a monetary payment or to the payment of a number of sheep or a number of camels, that's fine. Or they might say, we need people. We don't have enough people now because you killed somebody who came from our clan. And so you have to compensate us by giving us other human beings. So in other words, the sin of murder is seen as a sin against the family of that person. And so if the family of that person, so that, first of all, Greenberg talked about the fact that the king is allowed to forgive for homicide. And now he's saying that in the ancient, that's how ancient Near Eastern law codes thought of it. But also the family of the deceased, the sin is against the family of the deceased. And so if they are happy, the state is not going to intervene. Bedouin law is no different. Among the Bedouin of Sinai, murder is compensated for by a tariff reckoned in camels for any life destroyed. Anytime you take a life, then you have to hand over a certain number of camels to the clan that has now been diminished through the death of a human being. The Quran is equally tolerant of composition. Believers, it reads, retaliation is decreed for you in bloodshed, a free man for a free man, a slave for a slave, and a female for a female. He who is pardoned by his aggrieved brother shall... be prosecuted according to usage and shall pay him a liberal fine. So even the Quran says that if there's a male removed from my clan, then the clan of the murderer have to provide a male. If it's a female, they have to provide a female. And there is how other societies before the Israelites and after the Israelites continued to relate to the idea of murder. In the Babylonian law of the goring ox, otherwise closely paralleling that of the Bible, no punishment is prescribed for the ox. You know, the idea, you know, we'll talk about this. What does it mean to say that an ox is hayat mita, that an ox has to be put to death for a crime? Obviously, the ox, it's hard to say that the ox is a volitional first degree murderer, but if you haven't seen where Greenberg is going, it'll become very clear very soon. He's going to the idea that the Bible has this very special idea about the sanctity of human law, life. On both of these counts, biblical law has been regarded as exhibiting archaic features. Oh, that's so old-fashioned that they think that, that there has to be capital punishment. To speak in terms of legal lag and progress, however, is to assume that the biblical and non-biblical laws are stages in a single line of historical development, a line in which acceptance of composition is the stage after strict talion. Strict talion means an eye for an eye. We'll talk about that concept also, and that an eye for an eye was the more primitive kind of idea. And then people said, oh, maybe if you poke out somebody else's eye, it would be good to give a monetary payment, which of course becomes the halachic position. And that's how the rabbis understood. So there are those people who want to say that the strict kind of attitude is the primitive attitude, but Greenberg will say, will accept none of that. This is not only incapable of being demonstrated that there is this progression. The actual history of the biblical law of homicide shows that it followed an altogether different principle of development from that governing Near Eastern law. So what is the principle that the law of the Hebrew Bible follows? A precise and adequate formulation of the jural postulate, the legal principle underlying the biblical law of homicide, is found in Genesis. For your lifeblood I shall require a reckoning, of every beast I shall require it. Whoever sheds the blood of a man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God was man made. Because we are all made B'Tselem Elohim, that's why there is a different attitude to homicide in Israelite law than the attitude to homicide that you find in other ancient Near Eastern law codes. There's something sublime about human beings. We are holy, so to speak, about human beings. We are made in the image of God. And that's why not only when another human being kills us, but even if an animal kills us, and that attitude, that idea became pretty established in Western society. I think it is still the case that in most countries in the Western world, when an animal is responsible for the death of a human being, the animal will be put to death. And why is this? It's because the high status of the life of a human being, because human beings are made in the image of God. To be sure, this passage belongs to a stratum assigned to late times by current critical opinion. It says, I know this passage from Breishit, the critics will all tell you that that's much later. Okay, however that may be, the operation of the postulate is visible in the very earliest laws, as will be seen immediately. So The biblical critics who believe in the documentary hypothesis will say that the Covenant Code was written many years before the line there about the image of God was written in Bereishit. But Greenberg says, even if you believe in what the critics say, you have to admit that the law reflects this kind of idea of the special nature of human beings. The meaning of the passage is clear enough, that man was made in the image of God. The exact significance of the words is not necessary to decide here. What does it mean to be? Okay, we don't have to go into that, but it means there's something very special about being a human being. It's expressive of the peculiar and supreme worth of man. Of all creatures, Genesis 1 relates, he alone possesses this attribute, bringing him into closer relationship to God than all the rest, and conferring upon him the highest value. The first practical consequence of this supremacy is set forth in Genesis 9:3. Man is allowed to eat beasts, with apologies to any vegetarians who are here in the group, but it is made clear in chapter 9 of Genesis that human beings are allowed to eat beasts. The establishment of a value hierarchy of man over beast means that man may kill them for food and sacrifice only. It doesn't mean that human beings should go around killing animals indiscriminately, but the animals may not kill human beings. A beast that kills a man destroys the image of God and has to give a reckoning for it, because the God is at the center of the law code, and God is at the center of the law of homicide. Now, this is the law of the goring ox in Exodus. It must be stoned to death. The religious evaluation inherent in this law is further evidenced by the prohibition of eating the flesh of the stoned ox. The beast is laden with guilt and is therefore an object of horror. This animal cannot be killed in such a way that one could be eating it afterwards. It has to be killed through stoning, as if it's on trial. The rabbis talk about conducting a trial for the animal before putting the animal to death. Babylonian law on the subject reflects no such theory as to the guilt the peculiar value of human life imposes on all who take it. Babylonian law is concerned with safeguarding rights. That's the this view of the uniqueness and supremacy of human life has yet another consequence that places life beyond the reach of other values. The idea that life may be measured in terms of money or other property, and a fortiori, kal vachomer, the idea that persons may be evaluated as equivalences of other purposes is persons is excluded. So that's, if there is an idea of the holiness and the value and the uniqueness of each human life, then each human life cannot be measured. And so if somebody harms my clan by killing somebody in my clan, we can't say, well, what is that worth? And what should be given to my clan in order to make up for it? So again, it's this godly idea being put into the fact that God is seen as being the author of the text, and the fact that human beings are seen as being, in whatever way you want to understand it, we are seen as being in the image of God. It makes human life something very, very special. Compensation of any kind is ruled out. The guilt of the murderer is infinite because the murdered life is invaluable. You can't figure out the value of it. So how are you going to assign a monetary value to it? The kinsmen of the slain man are not competent to say when he has been paid for. It's not just the sin against that other clan that it's missing somebody. It's a sin against the image of God. An absolute wrong has been committed, a sin against God, which is not subject to human discussion. The effect of this view is, to be sure, paradoxical, because human life is invaluable. To take it entails the death penalty. So that's, there is a certain irony here, because the only way of dealing with the taking of human life, according to the Torah, is to take another human life. Yet the paradox must not blind us to the judgment of value that the law sought to embody. So the Greenberg, I think, makes a strong and effective argument here, just a little more of the text. The sense of the invaluableness of human life underlies the divergence of the biblical treatment of the homicide from that of the other law systems of the Near East. There the law allows and at times fixes a value on lives and leaves it to the kinsmen of the slain to decide whether they will have revenge or receive compensation for their loss in money or property. So there are these two possibilities given to the family of the deceased. They could either get revenge or they could get money. They are the ones who decide. They're the ones who are going to decide what is the value of the person from our clan who was killed. Perhaps the baldest expression, the economic valuation of life, occurs in those cases where punishment of a murderer takes the form of the surrender of other persons, a slave, a son, a wife, a brother, instead of blood, or to wash out the blood, or to make good the dead person, as the Assyrian law codes phrase it. So that's what human beings, that's what you do when, according to these ancient Near Eastern law codes, how are you going to make good the fact that the person died? Equally expressive are the Hittite laws, which prescribe that the killer has to make amends for the dead persons by giving persons in accord with the status of the slain and the degree of the homicide. The underlying motive in such forms of composition is the desire to make good the deficiency in the fighting or working strength of the community, which has lost one of its members. This seems to be the meaning of Hittite law number 43. If a man customarily fords a river with his ox, another man pushes him aside, seizes the tail of the ox, and crosses the river, but the river carries the owner of the ox away, they, meaning the authorities of the respective village or town, shall receive that very man. So the person who was responsible has to be transferred. He killed somebody from a different town, so it gets transferred to that town so that the town doesn't lose its strength. This view of life as a replaceable economic value here reaches its ultimate expression. The moral guilt of the homicide is so far subordinated to the need of restoring the strength of the community. There's no particular decision here that this person has to be punished for doing such a terrible crime. The idea is that we're only looking at the survivors of the murder victim and what can we do to help them. So we say, okay, we'll transfer this guy from one town to another. The moral guilt of the homicide is so far subordinated to the need of restoring the strength of the community that the culprit isn't punished, but he's incorporated. He's going to be part of this new community. This is the polar opposite of the biblical law, which requires that not even the flesh of the stoned homicidal ox may be eaten. The ox that kills, we're not allowed to say, okay, you know, he killed somebody from our family. At least give us the ox, and then we'll have something. We'll have the flesh of that ox to eat. It won't compensate for the fact that a human being in our family was killed, but something will be accomplished by doing this. But that's not what the biblical law. That is what the ancient law codes of the Near East were trying to do when they dealt with cases of homicide, but that is not what the Bible is trying to do when it deals with cases of homicide. It is trying to protect the sanctity and the importance of human life, and it's declaring that that there's only one way of treating a murderer. Okay. Okay, fine. You know, I might, since this is the end of a unit here, perhaps I'll stop and I'll take a look at what it says in the chat. And if we have time after we look at the chat, then I'll go on to the next part of this session. Okay, here. Were people better then, or were we tried to avoid a two-front internal and vis-a-vis the Greeks, Romans? I don't know, two-front war. Ah, is it possible that, this is a comment about the rabbinic literature, is it possible that since the Israelites were so busy fighting against the Greeks and the Romans, and we're getting particularly against the Romans, we're talking here in the second century, is it possible that that's what led them not to be eager to be killing each other with capital punishment? Yes, that is a possible way of understanding how it happened. If the rabbis are truly reflecting a long-standing view of capital punishment, what did they propose to do with murderers who got off on a technicality that they've created? The city of refuge was meant for the accidental murderer. No, was the Goel Hatam allowed to pursue an acquitted murderer? These are great questions, and it is not made clear in the in rabbinic literature what they're going to do with all these people who get off the hook. Now, would the Goel Hatam, would the blood avenger, we'll talk about the blood avenger probably next week, would the blood avenger be allowed to kill someone who was let off the hook on a technicality? I'm guessing that the answer is yes. But we don't have very many texts that really describe in detail what the blood avenger can do and can't do. Okay. The goring ox is a danger to society. That is right. So getting rid of the goring ox, you're absolutely right, Susanna. It's not just that the goring ox has killed one human being, but there is the concern that the goring ox will, but we can say the same thing about somebody who's guilty of murder, a human being who's guilty of murder might do it a second time. What if the deceased had taunted the ox or tried to harm it, Lauren? I don't know the answer to that. I'm guessing that they would have still advocated the killing of the ox. Acceptance of composition, is that the same as compensation, Steve? Yes, it is. Compensation, of course, presumably composition results from either a typesetting in the original or from some misreading in the scanning of the article. No, the word composition, if you look in a dictionary, that is one of the possible dictionary meanings, but it's not something that we commonly use now in the 21st century. Okay, Steve says he dismisses the paradox too readily. It's precisely this paradox that is the essence of the argument against capital punishment, especially once we acknowledge the possibility of human error. But I hear what you're saying, but when you study Talmudic texts about homicide, I remember how troubled I was when I first encountered this, but I think I've come to peace with it a little bit more as the years go on. So there is a principle in the Talmud that says ein meit u'mashalem. You can't, if you're going to be put to death, you can't also be asked to make a payment. And in the Talmudic system, even if the person isn't going to be put to death, but he is worthy of being put to death, the Talmud says there is no monetary, the Talmud is, and I think it's following, you know, Greenberg's understanding of the biblical text, the Talmud is against any form of somebody paying a monetary penalty in a murder, even if the person is not going to be put to death. You asked correctly here in the chat, so what are they going to do with that person? And that is a problem to figure out what it is precisely that you're going to do with the murderer. But this idea that no human life can ever be measured in terms of a monetary value. Since God has representatives on earth, the prophet, the high priest, with the Urim and Tumim, can they change or commute death sentences? No, they cannot. Although we will talk about this next week, the fact that an accidental killer goes to a city of refuge and stays there until the death of the high priest. But in general, the answer to your question Can God's representatives change or commute death sentences? The general answer to that is no. Yes, and Ellen is certainly right. The rabbis transformed the role of the Goel Hatam. Can self-defense be a valid argument? Certainly self-defense can be a valid argument. Okay, maybe I'll go on a little bit here, back to the text here. Here's a medieval Jewish writer, the author of the Sefer HaChinuch from Spain in the 13th, 14th century. And he has a different explanation about why we don't accept compensation for a murderer. The principle of this mitzvah is understood. If the authorities would be allowed to accept a ransom from a murderer, the result would be that anyone stronger and richer than his neighbor who got angry would kill that neighbor and just pay the ransom. The people would be at each other's throats and the land would become unlivable. And this is, I think, obviously true, that if you accept the principle that as long as the family of the deceased is happy with the payment, that the state and the religion should not be mixing in, then it's a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for rich people being able to kill anybody who they want because they've got enough money and they can pay up. We know that people with privilege in society can get away with various things that other people can't get away with. But do we want them to be able to get away with murder? And if we say that there is a concept of a kofar, of a ransom that a murderer can give, then it further preserves the stratification of society because the rich people are going to be able to be murderers, to afford to be a murderer. And this is certainly something that the Torah would not like. Okay. And this brings us to the next stage of the verse. Va'asher lo tzada v'ha'elohim ina liyato v'samti lecha makom asher yanus shama. If he didn't commit the murderer by design, but it came about by an act of God, then there is a place to which you can flee. So this seems to be written in, very short form and kind of in telegraphies. There will be a place, and that later biblical books will talk about setting up cities of refuge. So it's like this first law code, the law code that's associated with Ma'amad Har Sinai, with the right after the acceptance of the Torah, and the Decalogue is just outlining the principles that will be spelled out in later texts. So here is what Rashi says to explain the text. What does it mean that God caused it to happen? It came about by an act of God. Rashi says, what is scripture here referring to? There were two people, one of whom killed a person with premeditation, and the other one killed inadvertently. And in neither case were there witnesses to the deed who could testify about it. Consequently, the former, the one who committed murder with intention, wasn't put to death, and the latter wasn't forced into banishment to a city of refuge. So what does God do in a situation like this? Well, it's simple. Now God brings them together at the same inn. The one who killed with premeditation happens to sit beneath a ladder, and the other one who killed inadvertently ascends the ladder and falls upon and thus kills the one who killed with premeditation. Witnesses now being present, they testify against the one who fell. That one now has now been banished to one of the cities of refuge because he was responsible for an accidental act of homicide. The result is that the one who killed inadvertently is actually banished, and the one who killed with premeditation actually suffers death. So, in other words, in Rashi's worldview, behind the court system, the courts are, of course, the ones who are supposed to be enforcing these laws about premeditated murderers and accidental murderers. But what happens when the courts can't? God gets involved, according to Rashi. That's what Rashi says. That's what it means here, that that Elohim inaliado. So why would God cause somebody to be killed in this way? It must be, according to Rashi's understanding, because he was guilty of homicide, premeditated homicide, and he wasn't caught and he wasn't prosecuted. And so God will work everything out. This is not Rashi's innovation. You can see at the bottom on the Hebrew side that Rashi is expanding on a text from the Gemara here. And so Rashi sees that God is in the business of trying to enforce the laws of the Torah when human beings are unable to enforce those laws. Here is, though, another understanding. Shadal, Rabbi Samuel David Luzzatto, writing in Italy in the beginning of the 19th century, has a different explanation of what does it mean to say Elohim ina liato, that God caused this thing to happen. Here's his principle. Anything that a person does not do purposely and willingly is ascribed to God, the first cause, for what we think of as an accident occurs by God's decree. That Shadal does not like the theology, I think, behind Rashi's comment here about God getting involved in order to straighten the score out here about these murderers. And what he prefers to say is that, of course, everything is attributable to God. So if it isn't attributable to a human being, if it's an accidental thing, if there was no premeditation, then, of course, God is the first cause of everything. And then, I will designate for you, Shadal says, a place. I will establish for you cities of refuge when you arrive in the land, as Rashbam says. So that's if it's something that's not attributable to human volition, and which we are attributing to God because we think that everything comes from God, then we have this idea of the city of refuge, and we'll have more to say about this kind of theology, about Shadal's theology and his understanding of the text, and about cities of refuge next week. But now I'll just go back to the chat and see. Can we not read verse 13's Elohim as the human judge? Ruth asks. I wouldn't say we can't, but I think it would be a difficult reading of the text. Asher lo tzada, he didn't do it in a premeditated way, but the judges caused it to happen. I don't see it working smoothly. What right would a human judge have to make such a thing happen? Ellen says, I agree with that. Yes. Okay. Interesting that the Sefer Achinuch assumes that the kofar would go to the authorities and not to the family of this deceased. But his point is not that different from current society, where those who can hire better, more expensive lawyers can get away with murder. Yes, I agree with that concern. Yes, and Justin writes that in U.S. Civil War, the North allowed buying out of military service for $300, caused riots. Yes. Ellen thinks that the Rashi on the two killers seems awfully naive. Don't quote me, Ellen, but I think I agree with you. What does ina really mean? It means to cause something to happen. It's an unusual word, but it does occur in other passages. How can Rashi say that when he sees that God hasn't done that so often? Zoom user asks. Yes, it's a great question, and that's a little bit of the issue of the naivete of this approach. It does, because we all know that it doesn't always work out this way. But Rashi would like to say that sometimes it does work out. Any last comments before we say goodbye?
Yeah, Beck, can I say something?
Please.
I mean, I wrote it in the chat, but I guess you kind of missed that.
Sorry.
Back to the whole issue of who can abrogate a death penalty. Basically, that's what David did for Avshalom when he killed Amnon.
Yes.
The With question a little help from a prophet, by the way, to somebody else's.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. There are stories in the Bible about it happening, but often, how can I say this nicely? Often things that happen in Nevi'im Rishonim and in Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings don't totally conform to Torah law and certainly not to later halacha. But you are right that is what happened.
Two questions. One is about the general statement about the rabbi saying that if a Sanhedrin killed once in 70 years, it was a killing Sanhedrin.
Right.
The rabbi lived 300 years after, as you say, after the loss of sovereignty, how do we know that indeed when this Sanhedrin was in existence, it didn't kill, it didn't push the death penalty when the people that wrote that lived so long after.
Right. Okay, it's not quite 300 years, but you're absolutely right. And that was George Foote Moore's point. He said, okay, this is very nice, very sweet, this protection of human life, but these texts were written by rabbis who were not responsible for protection of the public order in society, because they were living under a cruel Roman occupation. They did not have any jurisdiction to be dealing with these issues, and they could come up with, so that's Moore's way of understanding it, that these are obviously the ideas that that only could develop at a time when they're not actually enforcing the public order in society. And then if you're interested, you can read Blitzstein's article, in which he argues strongly against this and argues that within the text of the Torah you can find some kind of ideas that led to this development.
If I may be permitted one more question. The whole issue of the Goel Adam and the Ruach is one that bothers me, because well, maybe we'll get to this next week, but why did the Ruach have to run? Why is he not protected from the Goel?
Very good. We'll deal with that next week, Marty. It's a great question. Why does he have to run away to a city of refuge? We will deal directly with that question next week. And you'll tell me next week whether you like the answers that will be presented. We will address that question next week. It's 12 o'clock on the East Coast and 7 p.m. in Israel. I'll say goodbye to you all and see you all next week.